I was trying to think. Was trying to think of a good intro to the podcast, but I don't need a good intro to the podcast. What's up, ding dongs? It's the spectacle. Welcome. Thank you for being here with us. I'm drinking tea. I got a headache. I'm here with my friend Dan Abbott. I'm excited for this one. Say hi to the people, Dan.
Hi, people. Hi. I'm excited to be here too.
Yeah. This is going to be a weird one, and I've known Dan for a long time, back when I was a little Chaos Punk, and I've wanted to get Dan on the pod for a grip now. You might know Dan from the legendary anti-punk East Bay band, Bobby Joe Ebola and the Children McNuggets. Hobo Goblins, Tumbleweed Time Machine. Were you in the Bob Weirdos?
Yeah,
I was
in the Bob Weirdos.
The band, where John would go on stage and light himself on fire.
We all lit ourselves on fire. It became kind of fire, nudity, and vomit core.
See, that these are things that we've lost. We need to return to in punk rock. We drove to Florida together. Remember that an insane rich man flew us to London one time
the Englishman.
The Englishman with all of his money, who said, anyone who's ever even spoken to Green Day, I want to play my little festival, and then Green Day will notice me. Some people seemed upset on that trip. I got a free trip to London. That was awesome.
I had the honor of seeing a videotape of myself blacked out for the first time, wandering the streets of London. And luckily, I was just a louder, dumber version of myself.
Yeah. Did they catch the time when you were carrying your hard shell guitar case, smashing it into like shuttered shop windows, shouting "Destroy"?
No, I don't. I don't think that was on the video.
Well, that's a fine memory that's burned into my mind.
Wow. Thanks. I was wondering where those scratches came from.
Yeah, something very heroic is where they came from. Dan's a great storyteller and has been around for some very iconic and very inspiring things. And I wanted to have Dan on for something that we could utilize his talents properly. Before we get too far into it, let's get a little plug out of the way up top, because Bobby Joe Ebola has a Patreon raising money for some sort of a golden idol or something.
Yeah, that's more or less it. We've sunk back into our horrible addiction of making overly ambitious art. We're making our first album in, good God, 12 years. And so far it's going well. We've got 20 songs and at last count over 50 musicians. And we're sort of letting people see the process on Patreon. So if you want to check out patreon.com/BobbyJoeEbola, you can find us there. And we have little videos, and we're telling tour stories and little essays that I write about the stuff that we're doing in the studio and why we can't seem to quit each other.
Yeah, it's a good band. Dan's a great writer. Dan was my dungeon master for a while.
There was a period of time where I was a dungeon master for hire.
Oh, you're not doing that anymore.
Well, now I have my regular copywriting job, but I'm still, have dice, will travel. So if anyone really needs a DM within, say, a day's drive of like Reno, I'm willing to consider offers.
This comes highly recommended from me, a stranger to you probably. But anyway, so This podcast, the podcast we're doing right now.
This one,
okay. The very same. So the spectacle, I guess the vague conceit, other than a make work program for me done by Strangers in a Tangled Wilderness, the very good publisher, is a show about geek stuff for anti-authoritarian freaks. And I'm very interested in freaks finding each other to do real life freak shit. And coming out of the pandemic, I was sort of hoping for some high weirdness, but everyone's on their damn Tamaguchis and kids aren't drinking 40s in abandoned buildings anymore. But there seems to be a lot of alienation and strange ideas. The idea for this particular episode came out of someone telling me they think that comic conventions are temporary autonomous zones. And yeah, that's a stupid idea, but it's a very interesting idea, that a very interesting brain.
It might be the closest that some people get to a temporary autonomous zone.
Exactly. That is exactly what I was thinking. I've been to a lot of comic conventions. I'm into geeking out, but not so much places mediated by consumption like that. I don't really think you can, we can get into what temporary autonomous zones are later, but if only there were places for geeks to really gather, some sort of a geek fest.
I think I'm smelling what you're stepping in.
Yeah. I'm kind of interested in, if nobody, knows much about East Bay punk rock history, well, you're probably about to hear some of it. I want to hear, Dan tell us some stories about the not too distant past from the general area we both grew up in to hopefully inspire us here in the highly alienated post 2020 landscape. So,
okay. Well, it was 1995.
Smash cut to Bay Area, the 90s. It's what was in the 90s? Neon? Nirvana playing.
There was Star Trek The Next Generation.
Yeah, everyone was wearing Picard shirts. Green Day plays their last show at Gilman Street under a fake name before being banned because they signed to a major label and kind of blowing up the spot. And yeah. Hot Topification had everybody stressed.
Yeah, and, you know, that's actually a very good jumping off point because, you know, my bandmate Corbett and I went to high school in the same high school that Billy Joe and Mike from Green Day had gone to. They were a couple of years ahead of us. But they, you know, like their music or not, they were the guys that got out of our hometown.
Mm-hmm.
And so we looked up to them for that. And, you know, Gilman was in Berkeley, which was 10 miles away from Pinole, where we were from. But if you didn't have a car, it might as well be 100 miles.
Yeah.
Those
streets get hot in the summer.
Yeah. And by the time I got out of high school and the band had formed, the Green Day effect on Gilman Street had already happened in that there was suddenly a self-consciousness about, wow, you could make a living from punk rock, which had not really been a thing before. Mm-hmm. People had taken their shitty little bands to Gilman to play with and for their friends. And when Green Day started getting big and A&R guys started coming to Gilman to look for the next big Green Day, the people that ran that venue started getting really self-conscious, and the scene itself started to tightly define what was and wasn't punk. Mm-hmm. Anything that had potential to be widely popular was sort of shunted away as being sellouts. right? So yeah, there was a move away from pop punk, a move away from anything that might have mass appeal.
This was also a time when Gilman was pretty much the only all ages place in the Bay Area, at least in the East Bay, right?
Yeah, there was one other place, the Berkeley Square, mm-hmm. Which was it was a good place to get exploited. The guy that booked there was this crazy dude in Bailey. He looked like the what was Krusty the Clown's sidekick, Sideshow Bob. He looked like Sideshow Bob, but dressed all in black leather. And
oh, that rocks.
Drugs and underage girls would disappear into the back room and never be seen from again.
Oh, that doesn't rock.
One of those kind of places. It rocked less than we would like.
Rats.
But that's actually where we got our start, because Gilman wouldn't book us. We were an acoustic comedy duo that did like novelty songs. We weren't wearing black. We weren't singing about chicks or Reagan. And
there was a great anxiety about like what was and wasn't punk. And they were sort of trying to protect like in full fight mode against anything once they saw like the wolves at the door. But like, yeah, it got everyone got really, really anxious and really, really serious about what was punk. So like,
yeah. There was an explosion of cores. Everything was subdivided into this core and that core. And we were, by almost any metric, we were not considered punk. Mm-hmm. But we were still inspired by that scene and the punk ethos and all that stuff. So we put out our own album, and we tried to actually put out an advertisement in Maximum Rock and Roll, which was the magazine out of which the Gilman Project had sprung. Mm-hmm. And the guy who was still in charge, Tim Yohannan, he very nicely, but firmly rejected us, saying that we were just a little too poppy.
This is an Econo Christ.
Right. Exactly. And so we were pretty bummed. Cause you know, we liked Gilman and we wanted to be part of that community, but, they didn't want anything to do with us. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, no, we're not anti Gilman here, but, still kind of a very strange sort of, PTSD move because they saw Blink-182 follow, like, getting popular right after like everyone's friends were suddenly millionaires or something close to that.
Yeah. And there was basically no world in which an A&R guy would see us singing songs about killing and eating children and be like, those guys,
that's what
I want to put those guys on MTV.
I'm going to get that Carson Daly talking to these fine fellows.
Right. So what we kind of did was we started putting on our own shows. And because in order to really understand this, you have to understand that during the Clinton administration, Bill Clinton decommissioned a lot of military sites that weren't in use. Right. There was a cut in military spending where they were like, okay, you're not really using this site anymore. And one of those was a place in Richmond, California called Point Malate, which had been an old fuel depot, and it was horribly toxic. So the Navy had to give it to Richmond, California. Richmond didn't want it, because it would have meant they had to do an environmental impact review and find out like, oh, good, it's a Superfund site. We can't do anything with it. And so it was in this weird legal limbo. And it was just this toxic little beach. So we rented a generator and got us some mics together and basically invited all of our friends' bands who also couldn't play anywhere else. And got about 11 bands, and I think the idea was that we were going to sell hot dogs and make our money back, which no one liked cheese dogs. So I'll take the L on that one. I really thought they would be popular. So we started doing these shows and we called it Geek Fest because we were, you know, we were geeks. We had been picked on for being nerds and being into D&D and like, you know, just generally being weirdos. And one of the things that we did was we kind of stole some ideas from the rave scene.
Damn, that was my first question. Is just like, how tight were you with rave culture? Because they were the original sort of steel spaces. And
right, yeah, exactly. So, I went through a period where I was going to raves. It was a good way to spend my cash.
I'm going to a rave tonight. And hell yeah,
yeah. And there was a group in the Bay Area that did sunset raves at Point Malate once a month. And we were like, well, we're not any louder than them. Like, why don't we just roll up on the same beach that where they do stuff? We kind of copied some of their tactics as well. You know, in the ages before cell phones, you had to list your directions like on an answering machine. So you would on the flyer, rather than list the address, which would make it easy for the cops to bust, you would just list your hotline. And then people would have to listen to the message and get the directions that way.
This is still a very good tactic I see employed by lots of people. Cops are, as far as I know, cops have never gotten smart enough to call those places and put in the legwork to bust places like that. And it's a lot less.
Their hooves are not dexterous enough.
No, they can't
to dial the numbers.
Yeah, they can't get over tough routes or muddy terrain, as well as use a smartphone, despite what you see on the New York subway. That's still a way of keeping it away from the like ask a punk type thing that keeps it in one scene.
So we got ourselves a hotline, a dedicated phone number, which my understanding is it's still in use today by certain groups in the East Bay. Mm-hmm. 510 Bad Smut.
6 years ago,
which we were very excited about.
Oh yeah, what a get!
It's also 510 Bad Pot, POTT. So that, but no, everyone vetoed my idea of doing 510 Bad Pot. They were like, no one will come. I'm like, no one's going to come anyway.
People want bad smut more than what is bad putt, Dan?
Yeah. So we had so much fun the first time. It was just a big janky mess that we're like, let's do this again. And during the seasonable months, we started doing it about once a month and we would make flyers and bands started calling the hotline and leaving messages asking if they could get booked. And now you have to understand that Gilman at the time was screening all their bands for like they were reading your lyrics and stuff to make sure that you weren't a racist or a homophobe or anything. Mm-hmm. But they were screening all the bands very carefully just to make sure that they were like stylistically, you know, would fit with the aesthetic that Gilman was going for. Mm-hmm. And we sort of did the opposite. We were just like, oh, what's your band's name? Yeah. Okay. You're playing at 2 PM. And so we would book anyone who wanted to play, which meant a very wide range of quality and styles. And you know, some bands they would play and just get like stony silence, because they sucked or they were assholes or whatever. And they wouldn't come back, but some people, you know, they would start playing and immediately we were like, oh, we love you guys. You're kindred spirits. Please play every single time.
Cancel culture wins again.
Right. Exactly. Like your mother.
My dear mother,
they played the second Geek Fest, and they came through and were just, they were awesome. They were doing melodic hardcore versions of Weird Al songs.
Yeah, they fucking ruled.
And at the end of the Geek Fest, we were like, you guys are awesome. You guys doing anything after the show? Let's hang out. And they're like, oh, we'd love to, but half the band is going to go see Weird Al tonight. We're like, oh, that's awesome. And they're like, and the other half is going to go see Slayer. We're like, okay, we're in love.
What a band.
We have been friends for almost 30 years with those guys now.
Yeah, great band. I haven't been able to find. I'm going to talk to you after the pod because I used to have their files on a computer. I poured water all over. So I need some more ones. But it sounds like GeekFest sort of helped spawn its own sort of subculture in the East Bay. That was something adjacent or resembling punk, but just way more DIY at that point because
it gradually drew a certain type of person that was generally an outcast from the punk scene or from some other subculture. So we got a pretty diverse array of weirdos. We got goths and metalheads and punks and just like weird little nerds. 13-year-old kids who drive 2 hours to come play for a half hour to 25-year-olds. And then we never hear from them again. It's
beautiful.
One of the things that really set GeekFest apart was the ambiguity. We didn't list the set times. There was no headliner.
Mm-hmm.
We would have 11 or 12 bands playing over the course of 8 hours. And you never knew when any of the bands were going to play. So you kind of had to stick around for the whole day.
Just one stage, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it gradually drew the people that were okay with that kind of ambiguity and, were down with just doing silly shit in the park with their friends and then, Foam Swords gradually got involved.
Yeah. Tell me about Amptgard. Is that how you pronounce it?
Well, yeah, it's Amptgard. I think it's a Viking term or something, but it's basically a live action role-playing system that's sort of foam boffer weapons where, you hit someone and they pretend like they lose a limb. And it's like live action D&D,
yeah.
Right? And one of our sort of core members, Mr. Dylan Blackthorn, he showed up one day at one of our Geek Fests dressed like M. Bison from Street Fighter with a Volvo full of foam weapons. and it immediately became a big part of Geek Fest. Where he just threw a bunch of foam weapons in the middle of a circle pit, and without missing a beat, everyone picked up foam weapons and started battling in front of the bands.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it was awesome.
I've seen incidents where outdoor festivals, like I was watching Citizen Fish and someone just threw a soccer ball in the middle of the mosh pit and it stopped immediately and everyone started playing kickball. Like, weird things can happen if you just give people the tools. They'll know what to do. But that sounds so beautiful, combining LARPing with a weirdo show on this toxic coast. Also, didn't somebody find an AK-47?
Someone did find an AK-47. Another thing to remember about the mid 90s was that Richmond was consistently batting way above its weight in terms of murders. It was not just per capita, but in total murders, it was every year competing with, Washington, D.C. and L.A. and Chicago. There was a Richmond was a very tough place to be. Certain parts of it. Mm-hmm. Point Malate was sort of the last exit before you got on the San Rafael Bridge that goes to Marin County. So if you were going to dump a weapon, that's a good place to do it. Yeah. At the time I was, you know, a little weirded out. But I think if that happened today, I no one would have heard about anyone finding an AK-47 in the mud. I don't think.
Yeah. Free gun.
I would take it home and clean it up and treat it like a little baby.
Yeah. They are. Those guns are meant to get muddy.
Yeah, exactly.
How did, I just got sidetracked with like, damn, I would love to fight somebody with a sword, with a foam sword at a punk show. We've got a lot out at the mountain. Maybe we should work it out. What do you think the ratio of people who were just there to spectate versus like people who were there with a band, who were there doing something creative was like when it started and as it evolved?
I think when we originally started, I was doing the math and I was like, you know, if everyone brings, like if every band brings like four people, that's like a big show, mm-hmm. right? That's like 50 people, right? Not counting the bands. In reality, most bands brought between zero and two people to see them that weren't in the band. So it was mostly band members, significant others of band members, and like a growing core of regulars who were there at every Geek Fest. Mm-hmm. And it was a kind of like, if you know, you know, kind of thing. You know, we weren't putting out ads in papers. We were just flyering our weird little scene. Most of the Geek Fests probably had, you know, maybe 60 to 100 people. You know, there were times where we had as many as like 200 to 250 people if like a really significant band was going to play. But for the most part, it was just like weird little East Bay bands, the occasional touring band, and our, you know, we were all just homies. We were mostly playing for each other.
And after a couple of years, it hooked up with the Pirate Punks, right?
Yeah. Yeah. We found out there was a group in San Francisco that was doing roughly similar stuff to us in the toxic waters of San Francisco. And they were doing Pirate Punks picnics. And so we sort of like, we started collaborating on shows in the Mission. The Mission punk and metal scene was pretty hot at that point. Mm-hmm. So they were doing some pretty big shows, bigger shows than us for sure. And eventually, to celebrate our first anniversary, to celebrate a year of doing Geek Fests, we thought, well, what if we do a camp out? Let's do a little thing out in the woods. And we did I think we had 40 bands for the first Geek Fest camp out. And the following year we did it again, but this time we were in collaboration with the Pirate Punks. And this became the first Libertatia.
Mm-hmm.
We sort of each booked half the bands. So it was half geek bands, half pirate bands. And the pirate punk bands tended to be metal or punk oriented, whereas the Geek Fest bands could be kind of all over the place.
Yeah. They were far more extreme. And when I was growing up, I didn't hear about Geek Fest until later, but I heard about Libertatia a lot.
Sure.
As not even a part of like the, I was in more of like, I guess like a generation or two below sort of geek punk adjacent scene, but not the extreme hardcore scene that pirate punk sort of trafficked in. But combining that, did it seem like, how did that fusion go? Did any like problems arise, or was it like just made it weirder and weirder and cooler and cooler?
For the most part, it was just really cool and everyone enjoyed it. There was a little bit of a fake rivalry. You know, like, oh, this show is going to be pirates versus geeks, which was fine. Marcus, the guy who was Marcus da Anarchist, who is anything but.
yeah, get his ass.
Yeah. He was doing all the flyers because he had a very distinctive style, and he was good at promotion. And so he would sort of play up the rivalry. Some people who sort of showed up later didn't understand that that was all just made up and a joke, and that we all really liked each other.
We're at war, but we're doing festivals together. Go figure.
Right, exactly. It was very dumb. And for the most part, we all really enjoyed each other's company and loved each other's bands, and just generally had an awesome time. When it came time to do cleanup, that was mostly a geek thing.
Fascinating. Punks shirking responsibility, you say.
We found out the limits of their commitment to anarchist principles when it came time to walk around Lake Ladoga with a melting garbage bag to pick up the bottles they had dropped.
Yeah, everybody wants to have a fun festival. Nobody wants to pick up the garbage.
Right. Yeah, and that was one of the things that, like, it was a gradual introduction for me into not just the music, but the culture and the practice of people taking care of each other outside of the system.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we borrowed some pots and pans from Food Not Bombs for Libertatia.
Yeah, and you made sure everyone was fed like twice a day or something.
Yeah, we did oatmeal in the morning and either gruel or spaghetti at night. And
kind of like based meals.
Yeah. And we're talking like for the campouts, it was like 300 people.
Yeah. Makes sense.
So that's a lot of oatmeal.
Yeah.
I remember my housemate, Rick, he woke up, took some acid, and I had assigned him to do oatmeal. And after a while, there's a line of hungry people. And I go over and check on Rick, and he's just standing over the pot crying. I'm like, what's wrong, Rick? He's like, oh, I can't tell if the water's boiling. I'm like, oh, buddy,
Rick,
why don't you go swim? I'll handle the oatmeal.
You need to go change states. You can't handle oatmeal.
Yeah. So it was, I mean, those were the sorts of misadventures we had. The police in the area where we decided to do these campouts were not happy. It wasn't even in the cops. It was one BLM agent,
the Bureau of Land Management.
The Bureau of Land Management. We picked a place up in, the East Park Reservoir, Lake Ladoga. It's a little camping area with a, man-made lake. And we set up there, and the guy was really upset that we were having amplified music. But there were like Christian groups that would come and do the same stuff and like ride their jet skis all over. But he just objected to the swearing. And at one point he got all the sheriffs, to come, and sort of look down at us, from the ridge with their headlights shining at us. Whoa. While this band called Schizo was playing. And I don't know if you remember Schizo, but they were like a metal band where all the other members had left the band. So it was just the bassist, singing to backing tracks. And his whole thing was he would puke. He had this like green stuff he would drink, and then he would puke, and he had these like groupies, I guess. They would let him like puke into their cleavage. Anyway,
the 90s were such a like Toxic Avenger are real monsters type time.
Yeah. Yeah. And, he's doing his whole thing, and it's like 11 o'clock at night, and we see this ring of headlights from all these sheriff's vehicles, and he's just like holding up this skull and like pukes on the skull. And there are these women like taking their shirts off in front of him, and while he's puking and playing bass. And after that, like all the sheriff's cars just like backed away and like drove off. They're like, this is terrible, but there's no laws being broken.
I don't think we could get away with shooting them, and I don't want to deal with this. But like that also kind of like, I would be a little on edge, but what ambiance.
Yeah. I think part of the problem, part of the reason the law enforcement came out so heavy that year was because Bobby Joe Ebola had a mailing list, and I made a flyer for the mailing list for Libertatia, which took a Christian anti-abortion pamphlet that had like a, you know, really gruesome picture of an abortion. And I superimposed like the Burger King logo. And it was
Dan.
It was like, have it your way right away. Come to Libertatia. And like, and I guess someone on our mailing list lived in that town of Stony Ford, California. And somehow it got into the hands of the BLM guy, and he got a bug up his ass about it.
But he never got anything done.
Yeah. The townsfolk were mad at him because it was like, oh wait, there's 300 kids coming to buy overpriced cigarettes. Awesome.
Excellent. Yeah.
Yeah.
It all comes down to commerce.
Yeah. But, you know, over the course of a couple of years of doing that, we had a really tight scene of people that kind of became its own thing, separate and apart from the Gilman scene. Like we didn't really need them anymore. We had our own friends and stuff, but it was around that time that the people who were part of Geek Fest, they were also in their weird little punk bands, and some of them became volunteers at Gilman, and some of them became bookers at Gilman. And eventually our band was able to play, and like we played Gilman probably dozens of times.
Yeah, it's probably the first
over the next few years.
Yeah. Yeah, everyone got over the initial fear of Dookie getting released and them needing to circle the wagons for that long.
Yeah, there was a period of understandable paranoia, but by like 1998 or so, it wasn't so much a thing anymore, and they realized like no one cares.
Yeah,
like the brew pub that opened up across the street from Gilman was like the big drama. They were like, oh no, the frat boys, they're gonna come over and start fights with us. No one ever did.
Like, you just worry about your neighborhood getting gentrified. It is like, as a youngster going there and seeing kind of the old heads who were still holding on to like a very like, you know, stay punk forever. Of course, but holding on to a very strict spiky punk ideal of it was like kind of pathetic.
Yeah, and I see that online quite a bit from people that are, you know, clearly middle-aged and remember going to punk shows and are like, punk is about being offensive. Like,
yeah.
Nah, man. Like, take it from someone who was a suburban teenage edgelord. I loved getting a rise out of people, but that's not what punk is about. Like, it's, it took me, a few conversations once I got out of the suburbs where people gently took me aside for a little call in, like, hey, you know, that song you just sang, here's why that's kind of fucked up. And here's a zine. And like over the course
very
of,
sweet.
You know, touring aggressively, I had a lot of conversations that really like got me out of my own little parochial worldview and made me a much better person.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm a big fan of the call in because that made me the man I am today.
Yeah. And if punk could be said to be anything, it's DIY crowdsourcing everyone into just like cooler and cooler people. Become progressively cooler and fuck cops.
Yeah. I mean, I see it now as like an art movement that can stand alongside the, you know, the Dadaists or whatever, you know, that it's like it's specific to a time and place and sort of a technological situation where the idea is that you don't need to be Eddie Van Halen to get up on stage and play guitar. Like if you have something to say, your passion is more important than your technical skill.
And have people go fucking ape shit for while you're playing as well. You don't got to put that much thought into it. You just gotta mean it.
Yeah. Three chords and something truthy, you know?
Yeah. Or just doing a backflip and everyone's like, whoa, I love it when somebody almost hurts themselves on stage.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, punk part of like a movement, like the surrealist, like Dada, whatever. It has its time and a lot of people cling to it. And the same with, not the same with Geek Fest, because it really did end. 2001 was the last one, right?
Kind of. We had a few shows. Like there was one in like 2015 that we did, that was like a, I think it was like a 2-day thing in Oakland, like in a venue. It wasn't a Geek Fest, but it was it was Geek Brand Entertainment, you know, like a little fake logo that we created for ourselves. I think the last actual Geek Fest that we had was at Gilman. We did a few Sunday Geek Fests at Gilman. And you know, we were like, as long as we can do it for free and keep it all ages, those were basically the two criteria for, is it a Geek Fest? Is it free? Is it all ages? And anything beyond that was sort of up to anyone who wanted to do it. And, I believe that there were some kids who asked permission to use the Geek Fest name. I don't know if they ever did anything with it. Cause I was on to other things by then.
What do you, out of its whole history, what do you think was like, what was your favorite moment? And what do you think was like the band that made you, besides your mother, that, made you go, holy shit, what do we got here?
Let's see. I really enjoyed, there was the biggest Geek Fest we had, I think was in 2000. And that was probably, we had, I think 82 bands showed up out of the 100 that we booked, which was pretty good. And so we had, you know, it was also called the Week of Geek. Two of my favorite bands were the headliners. It was Captured by Robots.
Oh shit.
And Rosemary's Billy Goat.
Don't know that one.
Now Rosemary's Billy Goat, the members of that are now in a Black Sabbath cover band called Mac Sabbath.
Oh,
where they all dress up as McDonald's characters and do puns out of Black Sabbath songs.
I just saw them performing for Ozzy Osbourne himself.
Yeah. We got to open up for them one of our last shows before we called it in, I don't know, 2014 or so. We played a great show with Max Sabbath, and those guys, they're like metal guys, but their aesthetic or their mentality is very much punk rock. And they're just sweethearts. There was a time where we had a treasure hunt, at Libertatia.
This is my shit. Yeah.
Yeah. So
extracurriculars at the punk show.
Yeah. So we had a scavenger hunt, and everyone kind of threw in treasure into the scavenger hunt, from CDs of the various bands to t-shirts and stickers and some mushrooms and, like, you know, a little bit of cash and a couple bottles of booze. And it was all put in a chest, that was taken out to a secret location somewhere on the campsite. Which again was around a lake with a little island on it. So the treasure was secretly buried on the island, but this scavenger hunt, there were clues in various camps that people had, and you would go and visit this guy and he would give you this clue, and gradually you could put together all the clues and get the treasure map. Now there was a band called Scratch Habit, who went into Marcus de Anarchist's tent and just stole the treasure map.
I respect it.
Yeah. I respect the hustle and the, very, very Alexander the Great cutting the Gordian knot kind of thing. Let's out pirate the pirate.
You're going to get mad at it. I assume they got mad about it.
Everyone got kind of mad. Cause you know, we'd put a lot of effort into building this treasure hunt to entertain 300 people.
Fair enough.
And then these little kids had, like, stolen the treasure, and, like, we found out who it was and came upon them after they had already ingested the mushrooms.
The sun
had set. And so they were approached by an angry torch wielding mob as they're coming up on mushrooms. We had to think quick because it was getting out of control, and, like, people were very drunk and very mad. And, like, I was worried they were going to get, like, hurt for real. And so I was like, wait, let's have a trial. I don't know if it was me specifically that convinced everyone to have a trial, but that was the, you know, there was a crew of us that were like, wait, let's have a trial. And somewhere there's a recording of it because we were using microphones and the sound system. We got them a defense lawyer who was one of our LARPer friends, who was dressed just in furs as a barbarian and carrying a big foam axe. And he was stinking drunk. And he had this long rambling speech where he was just like, he tried to convince the crowd not to kill them. And that was like, that was the extent of his defense. And they were like, but we're like really high, man. And, like, it was a pirate thing and we were just pirating and, like, please don't kill us.
That's a good defense.
Marcus, I believe, was the prosecution. He didn't really have much coherent to say, but it definitely would, like, left open the possibility of killing them. and so things were not going well for them. Eventually, Amy Gutmonkey from Votsek and a bunch of other bands, wonderful lady, and a bunch of other very burly looking lesbians went over and just picked these guys up over their shoulders. And they thought they were going to get drowned. And just, like, threw them into the lake and kind of dunked them. And that was it. That was their punishment. And everyone just, like, immediately the mood changed. And everyone was just like, having casual conversation, like clinking beers and stuff, like, woo, let's go party.
You just needed the ritual.
Yeah, and really what the guys had stolen was the fun. Mm-hmm. They had stolen the fun of looking for the treasure, and that had to be rectified somehow. So we had to create some new kind of fun as a substitute. And so the trial, it wasn't a distraction. It was like, you took our fun. We're gonna make you into the source of our replacement fun.
I feel for these kids, because when I'm on psychedelics, I take very good care that nobody's mad at me. But and they did something that I can't say I wouldn't think of doing. But if I'm camping out and I know there's a scavenger hunt or a treasure hunt going on, and there's an island on the lake, I'm swimming to the. I'm not looking for clues. I'm swimming to the island. But, that is the best way it could have gotten solved, and everyone just not them not be make everyone just really bummed out and all this work for not. The work was at their wound up being at their expense, but everyone still got to have like a funny story about it. You wouldn't be talking about the treasure hunt all these years later if it wasn't for a big trial for these poor kids.
I mean, if someone had just like drowned them, I'd probably be talking about that too. But
you shouldn't talk about that though.
I mean, it wasn't me. And it was 25 years ago.
Yeah. Past statute of limitations for an accessory to murder. Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah.
Well, that is all like, this was all like a little before my time. And like hearing all these stories about Geek Fest, like we had our own things going. Once I kind of got into the weirdo punk scene back then, but nothing as formalized as Geek Fest. So it was this very, like, it was very mythic to me. It felt very like this beautiful thing that, like, I'm sure we got as much weirdness done, but like something being sustained like that for so long is very beautiful. But we can't trick ourselves into thinking the only things worth doing are things that last, because the more permanent something is, the more soulless.
Absolutely. It was beautiful partly because it was ephemeral. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we didn't know the first one we did, we had no ideas about doing more than one. We just thought, oh, let's just do this fun thing. And we had so much fun, we did it again. And that just kept happening until it became an identity for some people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember someone taking me aside at Geek Fest and saying, like, oh, you know, first time I saw you, your guys' band, I went home and cut off my mohawk. Because, like, it just all seemed like, you know, fashion to me after that. And I had to take that as a compliment, because it was like, your mohawk is not what makes you punk, right? It's not, you don't have to live up to anyone else's idea of fashion. You know, clothing is communication. And if you want to, right, if you're really interested in speaking to people in a way that they will understand and accept, then sure, you know, you can play along, but you don't have to. You can be your own person.
Yeah, if you want to fly a flag, do it. But like, yeah, cutting off a mohawk, especially, I assume this is like a younger kid. In it's a very profound kind of thing to come to around that age. If that is a huge part of your identity, you're going out to freak out the squares all the time.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know. I think about like the in Dumbo, right? The you know, the magic feather. It's like, he never needed the magic feather. He could always fly.
It's beautiful. You don't need your mohawk. You could always fly. Go ahead and try it.
And it really, like, working with my friends to make something fun and stupid gave me a frame of reference for all the other fun, stupid things that I did with my friends.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, not a lot of people get that much of a that much of a success story with DIY ethos.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it was, I was already on that pathway anyway. Mm-hmm. I didn't, you know, I wasn't reading the literature or anything. But just taking, like, in practice, doing things as a group without having anyone in charge and, like, having no concern for the monetary aspect of it. It was all, like, financially, it was all a disaster.
Yeah.
Right. And, like, you know, we're feeding 300 people at a big festival for, you know, no one's paying any money. Like, this is, you know, we're just like doing benefit shows all year just to do that.
You can either go two routes of something is aggressively free and affordable, and like you starve to maintain that, or you make something that can, like, no matter how radical it may seem, wind up subsumed by capital. Speaking of, Dan, you help build Burning Man every year, don't you?
I sure do. That's my summer job.
We don't really have to talk about it, but I kind of wanted to talk about Burning Man a little bit.
Yeah, sure.
I think most people listening probably got an idea of it, and it's probably different depending on what coast you grow up on. If you're in if you're in middle of America, I think there's like different. I've heard people kind of understand different based on like how many burners they actually encounter. I grew up on a real scummy street of like that from me there was like a crank house making crank, another house that was growing weed, and then John and Tim, the two Burning Man guys who like welded golf carts together, and that's how I first heard about it. And it seemed very cool when I was growing up. I think most people probably see it now as a place for like rich hippies to try out being weird and having community like all hollowed out and like the spirits stacked on as like adornment, but there's still amazing art out there. There's still genuine weirdos in some like management positions, especially and stuff. And it began as something that sounds really, really sick. If you're into people with guns, pretending money doesn't exist, doing drugs, making art, blowing stuff up, which I am. So like, do you think you could speak to like what the inspirations were, like what it was like, cause it sort of began as like a temporary, like inspired by the temporary autonomous zone, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know whether they did the thing and then found sort of intellectual justifications or the other way around. If like some dudes were hanging around smoking weed and reading Hakim Bey and were like, let's do a thing.
Yeah. But, that impulse has been there since humanity was around and maybe before that.
Yeah. I mean, for myself, like, you know, with regard to GeekFest, like we did the thing and then we found out like, oh, this kind of lines up with certain like anarchist ideas. And, you know, we dove a little further into that. With Burning Man, it was initially just like a spontaneous thing this guy did. Larry Harvey, he made a little effigy on Baker Beach in San Francisco. I think he had just like gone through a breakup or something. And so he wanted to like, just do something cathartic. So he made a little effigy of a person and burnt it on the beach and then, did it again the next year. And he did that for like 3 or 4 years and it became kind of a thing where there was, you know, a couple hundred people there. And then the cops finally told them like, you can't have this enormous fire on a public beach anymore. And so around that time, there was a group called the Cacophony Society. Mm-hmm. And the Cacophony Society were sort of prankster activists. Think like the Billboard Liberation Front, like that kind of stuff. And they would do public art, like public pranks. SantaCon came from these guys.
Oh no. Oh, we have so many bad things to blame them on, but I'm sure it's pretty cool.
So initially they would go into the shopping district in San Francisco during Christmas season and kind of accost people for their commercialism dressed as Santa. And it was just like a bunch of Santas just like making fun of all these shoppers.
Wow, this is
It became more of like a drunken frat boy thing, I think, quicker than they wanted it to. I think those guys finally had a funeral for it in 2004, because they were like, this shit has been over for years, but it's time to bury it.
Yeah. Good for them to have a ritual of it, though.
Yeah. And they would do, in the early 90s, they were doing a thing called zone trips, where they would take a bus and they would just go to a random place and have a party. And so they would, like, I don't know if you paid a little bit of money to get on the bus to help cover the gas, but they would go to random places and just have bizarre kind of art parties. And one of the zone trips they had was out to the Black Rock Desert in Nevada. And that was where they decided to burn the man in, I think it was like 92 or something. And so a bunch of people showed up to see this effigy burn in, you know, it's like 1,000 square miles of a cracked hard pan desert. Mm-hmm. It's like a prehistoric lake bed.
Mm-hmm.
It is extremely dry and extremely harsh. They get 60 mile an hour winds, blowing dust in your face, and then thunderstorms, and then floods, and like weird prehistoric shrimp come alive and start eating you.
Yeah, that's what happened last year.
It's a very weird place ecologically and historically. Like, they filmed some cowboy movies there. I think Marilyn Monroe and John Wayne were in a movie together out there. Anyway, that it became this party that was sort of outside the realm of the law, because it was federal land, but no one went there. Yeah, like, it was
going to bust,
you know. Yeah, but you had to bring everything. There's no plumbing, no water, you know. And they had to sort of develop an ethos of self-reliance. You have to bring all your own water. You have to bring a bucket to shit in. You have to, you know, and all anything you're going to bring that's fun, from weird costumes to your all your ammunition. You know, they used to do a drive-by shooting range where they would just set up targets and then just lean out the windows of their cars and trucks and just blow shit away.
That's so cool.
And you can still find clips of that on YouTube. And an old friend of mine, Otto, this old Gulf War veteran, used to do a thing called Frog Bat, where he would make a paper mache monster and fill it with explosives and propane, and then have like hundreds of people open fire on it at once. Most of them on some kind of psychedelic. It was not a safe experience. And eventually the lack of safety led to some deaths.
Mm-hmm.
This is like 97 or so. There wasn't really a structure. It was just people camped wherever they liked.
Yeah.
And someone ran over a tent. And, you know, a couple people died. And so at that point, the law enforcement got involved, and they're like, you can't do this anymore this way. Otherwise, you're going to be responsible. And at that point, Burning Man, the people who were organizing it had a choice to make of like, do we make this temporary autonomous zone go away in the face of encroaching law enforcement? Or do we organize it into something else and try and preserve what fun we can?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do we make it truly temporary? Or, I mean, this thing's got legs. It's got potential. It's going to lose something, but we can hold on to it. Like that's something that comes along with like lots of different things, a hard decision to make.
Yeah. And there was a lot of debate. Like one of the founders, a guy named John Law, he was like, it's over. We had a good time. Someone died and the cops came. Now we got to go.
Yeah. Didn't he make a Camp Tipsy?
No, that was,
Chicken John.
Yeah. Chicken John.
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure now, Camp Tipsy is done at the same place where we did Libertation.
I was going to bring that up. Yeah. Yeah. Camp Tipsy kind of came out of Burning Man, where you go to a dump, you pick up like stuff from the dump. They keep a part of the dump full of, wrapped styrofoam and barrels full of air and stuff. You go to this place that Dan described earlier, and all week you build a boat. And once you build your boat, you just live on your boat and you do whatever you want out on the lake on your boat. And then you just take it apart and leave after the week is over. I've been before, and I swam across the lake to get there every time because I'm not giving my money to Chicken John. And it was it's a lot of fun.
Yeah. Now, Chicken John was a very, very early member of what would become the Department of Public Works. He helped build Burning Man for many years. He and his weird punk rock circus, Circus Ridiculous, they were basically a bunch of clowns that would show up and with, you know, sledgehammers and you know, everything else, they would build what little infrastructure there was for Burning Man. Now, in 98, they had to get organized if they wanted to keep going. And at that point, they brought in the actual city design with the streets and the sort of the sort of circular design that is familiar today. It's more or less the same as it was. It's just a lot larger now.
Yeah.
And with it began the Department of Public Works, which I work for, which builds and maintains the infrastructure for the city. We don't actually, I mean, the artists build their own art and stuff, but we, for example, lay out the city grid and bring in different kinds of infrastructure. So there's water. Like we have water trucks coming in. There's fuel. Everything that you would need to survive in any city, it has to be brought in, and that has to be organized and built. Shade.
Yeah. But it is still a no money zone.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is a cute little fiction.
I can only imagine there is money changing hands.
I mean, when you're actually there, I can only speak as a worker, and there's nowhere to spend money really.
Yeah.
The only time you actually would use cash at Burning Man is buying ice at Arctica, which is like a whole thing where they have an ice machine. And people can buy ice because that can be a health issue.
Yeah.
For example, if you need to keep your medicine cool or something, or if you're buying drugs, those are the only two things where you would need money.
Yeah. That many people, I can't imagine, the barter system holds for very long with that many competing Molly dealers.
There isn't really a barter system so much as what is referred to as a gift economy.
Yeah.
The idea is that you get a certain amount of status from giving away. If you have a camp that's just, you know, a free bar where they're just giving you booze, like that makes you look like a cool guy.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And so it's real easy for a rich person to want to be the cool guy. And so they build the biggest camp with the most booze, or they're, you know, they're giving away this or that. And it's a way for people to sort of get status in a kind of neo-primitivist way, where, you know, they may not be a cool guy. But it's almost like tax deductible. Like, forget that I'm a CEO techie scumbag for 1 week, please. And pretend that I'm just one of the regular folks, except better than you, because this is all mine.
Yeah, because I can afford to get aren't I noble giving away all my wares for free to you fucking peasants. But like, right. Hey, I'll not spit in your face if you give me some free ketamine or something.
Right. And, you know, it should be said that everything you've heard about Burning Man is true.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Like, all the bad things you've heard about Burning Man, absolutely true. Also, all the good things.
Yeah. How much of that original spirit can you still find there?
I mean, I like to give it probably more shit than people who hate Burning Man, because I see the worst of it and I see the best of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's gone from a temporary autonomous zone to more like a theme park of temporary autonomous zones.
Yeah. You can play act like you're in one.
Yeah.
There
are amazing people there, right? You run into people who really are true believers, and this is what they spend their money on instead of Christmas, right? This is their week where they get to reverse all the things they don't like about the outside world. Mm-hmm. And it's very similar to Christmas in that, like, you see people like, what if it was like this all the time? Why couldn't it be?
Yeah. We can all decide civilization is a raw deal and experiment with something else for the week.
Right.
Yeah.
And it does change people's lives. You know, people get their heads shifted around, and they can bring that back to their world. The default world,
yeah,
as it's called,
the quote unquote,
and make changes. But a lot of times the changes are like, I'm polyamorous now. And, I am, I'm not going to pay my rent anymore. I'm just going to live on your couch.
Yeah. I'm going to incorporate a yoga studio in my tech startup and pay people according to this like half-baked Eastern spiritualism I heard somebody talking right. about when I was on Chinese Research Chemicals.
Right. But then you get people like Burners Without Borders.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So during Hurricane Katrina, Burning Man was happening. It was happening at the same time.
Huh.
And some people got really kind of bummed out about that. They're like, because, you know, in 2005, it was a little harder to get information from the outside world while you're at Burning Man.
Yeah.
They get out and they're like, holy shit, New Orleans has been destroyed. There's like people dying. Oh my God, this is unacceptable. We have all these construction skills. We're used to building entire camps. Why don't we go down there and volunteer our labor?
Mm-hmm.
So there's actually a group called Burners Without Borders where they take sort of the skill and the communitarian ethos that they picked up at Burning Man, and they go to disaster sites and places that need quick construction and other stuff that they can lend.
That's pretty sick. Yeah. And I know that there are like people who go like, I want to go to Burning Man. I want to see what's up there. And I know like some of the sweetest people I know from high school go and like genuinely enjoy it. I want to go ride around on like Mad Max cars with you and like do it as more of an anthropological study and like enjoy the thing, but just like, wow, this is, huh. And as somebody who's very interested in like temporary autonomous zones, seeing it brought to this kind of a conclusion sounds fascinating to me.
Yeah. And, you know, when I first went, the only thing I had to compare it to was Geekfest and some other gatherings I'd been to, like the Mutant Fest. And to me, it was just like that, but writ large.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, I've always been interested in the process. I can't go to a party and just like hang out and be cool. I have to either be cleaning up or like serving drinks or playing music or something.
Yeah.
Or I get nervous and have and drink too much and then ruin myself.
I'm the same way. Yeah. I need something to do with my hands.
Or I'm right.
Just mostly so, sipping.
I let myself get hoodwinked into working the season, which, you know, puts me out there for about 6 to 7 weeks. And I watch from blank, empty playa, a city of, you know, 80,000 people springs up and by my hand and the hands of my best friends. So it's pretty fun. If you want to live in a bikeable city with all your best friends for a week, you know, it's a very nice, fantasy, to inhabit and, you know, I enjoy watching things come together and I enjoy having a part in things and being like, I did that. Me and my friends did that.
Yeah.
I enjoy the build season far more than I enjoy the event itself.
Oh yeah.
I'm usually just like in my trailer most of the time hanging out.
Yeah. You've invited me for the build season. And I just can't ever get away for that long, but I feel like I would be like, yeah, I want to hang out with the like people who are there doing stuff. And like, then I'll wind up a smarmy asshole during the week of Burning Man.
I mean, by the time the artists start showing up to build their projects, you've already been out there for about 4 weeks, and it's just like, get off my lawn, hippie. You're gonna have to put some pants on before they'll let you in the iron skillet like that.
What's the iron skillet?
Iron Skillet is a chain of restaurants in California.
I thought that this was Iron Skillet. Yeah. Oh, this was a Burning Man structure. You know, I've heard, like, if nobody listening actually knows what a temporary autonomous zone is, it's just sort of what we've been talking about. It's not comic conventions, but it is sort of making shit happen that escapes civilization, that you don't really like cling to, that you can learn some lessons, take it back into the real world, can be whatever you want. There's a book about it written by a guy who wrote some weird shit about pedophilia. So
yeah, he's a real creep.
He's a real creep. So we're separating the word that he coined from the concept, because it predates him by a large margin.
Yeah, he was just observing on a phenomenon. The idea that there are these spaces of sort of festival and of celebration and of freedom that don't necessarily fight like their goal is to not survive forever. Mm-hmm. Their goal is to like spring up like dandelions in the sidewalk cracks.
Yeah.
And then, you know, when the law comes, you like fade away and then you build somewhere else spontaneously.
Yeah. It has a lot of makings of festival. It has a lot of makings of uprisings,
or even just like a bunch of skaters, like finding a place to skate. And then when the cops shoo them away, they go find somewhere else to skate, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
And like most people, I think got, if they know about it, they probably have heard it, Burning Man referred to it, or they heard about it, around, the uprising with the Chaz or the Chop. To me, in my, like for my money, a TAS is over as soon as it's named as such. And to me, the thing was totally busted when some people deputized themselves to keep people like in the uprising from torturing the police station when they had the chance to, because they thought it was a trap by the police. Like, imagine how bad we'd look if two police stations got torched in like an unprecedented national uprising, almost like a trend is developing.
That would have been unthinkable.
Yeah. What a fucking lost opportunity. Whatever. I wasn't there and you can't prove that I was. It's not near the biggest failure. They fucking shot some kids who were joyriding around there, like lawless things happening in a lawless space. The very idea, but, whatever. That's where I feel like if people know about it, they probably know about it from that. And like,
yeah, once someone's getting put in charge, it's not a TAS anymore.
Yeah, yeah. Once people have guns and kind of react to things like a cop might react, whether you thought it was a right wing attack or whatever, you got trigger happy. Like, I think I was really disappointed that that happened because I was excited to see it become a part, and I hope it still is part of a revolutionary strategy as like systems break down more and more, that we need like this decentralized proliferation of experiments in taking and holding space and living weirdly in them. And we need to not be afraid of like, of it being temporary and failing or holding on to it until a point where people start, where like, our people start getting killed in them. But like the good news is, you don't have to wait for conflict with the state to experiment with new modes of life. There have been enclaves in the hollers and maroon communities in the swamps that have lasted for lifetimes outside of control or even notice. An uprising doesn't have to engage directly with the state, and it doesn't have to be political, not as we've come to understand it. I think waiting for that kind of turns some people into these like revolutionary Calvinists, like, like revolutionaries don't lead modern uprisings. Like revolutions are just uprisings that sustain themselves. And like the revolutionaries, anyone who was like anywhere near the George Floyd uprising knows that everyone was playing catch up to regular people, anyone politically, like anyone who consider themselves revolutionary. Like those people take the credit later if it grows into a revolution. And I don't think revolution should necessarily be the aim of every uprising because you'll take, you'll just be taking credit. I have this quote from this book, Dancing in the Street by Barbara Einrich, that I read that is kind of in this vein. For men like Robespierre and Lenin, the central revolutionary right was the meeting, experienced in a sitting position, requiring no form of participation other than an occasional speech and conducted according to strict rules of procedure. Dancing, singing, trances, these could only be distractions from the weighty business at hand. And where are Robespierre and Lenin? That's right, dead, because they were no fucking fun.
Yeah, I mean, you don't need the theory to do something cool. Like in my experience anyway, all like any theory I read was after I was doing cool shit and was like, oh yeah, it's like the thing I was doing.
Yeah. It's when you read something and you're like, oh, somebody said, oh yeah, that's what I've been feeling.
Yeah. I've never read a book and been like, oh, you know, that would be a really cool idea. It's always the other way around. Mm-hmm. And I feel like a lot of people don't give their own imagination and their own whimsy enough credit. Like there's some genius in your stupid little ideas. And you don't necessarily have to think about the long term. Sometimes it's good, but you can just do a thing because it's cool, and it never has to happen again. Maybe it does. Maybe it's so cool that you have to do it again.
Maybe it inspires because somebody else to do the same thing.
Yeah. Like if the conversation that we're having today clicks on a light bulb in someone's head and they're like, wait, me and my friends could get together with a generator somewhere and have a stupid show. Like, it's not that hard.
It's not hard.
We were idiots. We had no idea how to put on a concert or promote it or do anything. And we found so many friends and kindred spirits just by doing something that we didn't know we couldn't do.
Yeah, I'm worried that I want people to believe in themselves. You can just do shit. You don't got to wait for anybody. There's a learned helplessness in, not in everyone, but that I see sometimes among people who are sort of waiting for bland shit to happen that they can participate in, whether it be like protests that'll funnel people into useless orgs, or just like parties that where everyone's got to rely on like taking substances to get themselves in any kind of like playful spirit. I'm interested in real life freaks doing real life shit. I'm interested in finding each other and like liberating areas to deny this like agreed upon capitalist reality, and like festivals in the forests, mass looting, squatted raves, LARPing, haunted house orgies, going into trances in the desert with strangers. Like, you don't got to cling to these feelings, disappear once the power wanes, like, and just take that feeling back to the quote unquote real world. Like, you can build utopia as long as you don't mind if it collapses.
Hell yeah. Yeah. Just cause you know, you might get your heart broken doesn't mean you shouldn't fall in love.
Fuck yeah. Yeah, that might be a good place to call it. What do you think?
Okay.
You got any extra thoughts?
No, not really. It's we also did run a record label and I put on a couple of other festivals, but we can come back to that
time. We'll do a part two someday and talk about spam records. What did spam stand for? It was like
smarmy post angst musicians.
Fuck yeah, it did. yeah, we'll get into that some other time.
Yeah.
You got anything to plug, Dan? Replug the Patreon.
Yeah. Yeah. We are making a new Bobby Joe Ebola album. It's going to be called Solar Cantata. And, if you are interested in finding out more, you can go to patreon.com/Bobby Joe Ebola, or you can just go to the Bobby Joe Ebola presence on the web or Facebook or whatever. And you can find me on what used to be Twitter at Professor Plague. And I'm the same way on all the other things.
I'm on the internet. Bumlung. I'm Bumlung on the internet. I'm still on what used to be Twitter. I'm waiting just to make one last good tweet and then I can mic drop my way out of there. So look out for that. It's just going to be something like, I like going outside with my friends or something. but I gotta, you know, the wording's not right quite there yet.
You hate the indoors.
I'm also on Instagram. That's kind of where I'm more active. I make comics and prints, and shirts and stickers and stuff. This podcast is also, brought to you by Strangers in a Tangled Wilderness, a cool publisher that employs me. We got comics, we got books coming out. We have books.
Oh yeah, I want to shout out the thing I'm reading right now, which is Penumbra City.
Oh yeah,
it's so good.
We just published an RPG. Yeah, what do you think, Dan? Let's get your hot review.
I really like it. I have been carrying it around with me for a couple months now since I got it in the mail, and I really like the mechanics. It's simpler than D&D. The classes are really fun, and the writing is like snappy and it's kind of informal. You really feel like sort of immersed in the world. I have a lot of thoughts about it, but it's so far so good. I'm not quite done with it.
Thank you. Yeah, I think it's very good, and you'll probably think it's good too. You can find it.
I have so many ideas for an actual play of that.
Let's talk off mic. All right. I think that's all. That's a podcast. That's all of it. Okay. From everyone here at me, I'll see you at the movies.